students to think that we don't go to class. You know what this means? The kids who show up on time at the beginning of the semester, those are the A students.
And everyone else, we shall adjudge them accordingly. Sound fair? All right, we're not doing the Crusades in here. I did that. This is what we're doing. Oh. You guys signed up for class that deals with one of the most important events of the 20th century.
Thank you.
The war to end all wars.
Sorry, I'm late. I'm super bad.
Yeah, they are. I'm glad you're here. Who are you?
I'm Riley.
What?
Riley.
Would you be Irish?
Day is green.
What's your last name?
LeBron.
So, as we are going to see over the course of the semester, the big event that we're going to talk about is the war that transformed the world from a world dominated by six or seven great powered nations, almost all controlled by monarchies, into the world that would pave the way for other fun things, like another world war and a Holocaust. And a whole bunch of other stuff. World War I. Big time event. But before I get into stuff, I'm going to tell you homework. You all have homework assignments. You should have gotten a notification because I punched it through Engage when I was on my break. And that involved a quiz. You're going to have to take it at some point tomorrow. Some point between 8 a.m. and 11:59 p.m. The quiz is purely for extra credit. So you who are here have the advantage of explaining what it's all about. Whereas the people who decide not to show up, well, they're going to miss out. Because, by the way, if I say quiz, that always means extra credit. And who doesn't like extra credit? I'm not doing a syllabus review. Instead, I did a pre-recorded video. That video can be found in Engage. It's about maybe halfway down as you start scrolling. If you get to the paper in the exams, you went too far, go back up. The video, I cover what or how I'm going to run this class. And you two have had me before, so it's basically the same thing. The only difference is I don't know if I had three exams when you guys had me or four. I don't remember where we're at, but we're doing four this semester. So if you're not enrolled in Engage, make sure you get over to IT and get it corrected. A couple of things you're going to find in Engage, not only all the stuff about the class, not only the video where I actually go over what's in Engage, but I also talk about my website. That's something else that's going to be pretty useful because I do PowerPoint to keep me on task, but I give you everything you're going to see on the screen in advance. But that's accessible through my website. So watch the video today, or tomorrow, whatever. The quiz, you got 10 minutes to do it. You will not see it today. The quiz will open up tomorrow. Take the quiz, get as many extra credit points as you can, and start the semester off on the right foot. But what we're going to do, obviously, is we're going to do kind of, well, I mean, obviously, this is a 200-level class, so it'll be a 200-level class. And we're going to talk about a very complex event that had a huge, huge impact in shaping the world. An event that probably, you could argue, was inevitable, the way everything was going. So in my global history, that's what they call it, global history class two, we spend a good chunk of the semester talking about the fact that as the European powers gobbled up more and more control over more and more lands in the world, they basically were headlong into a crash course. Because eventually what happens is you run out of land. And if these nations are competing for resources and wealth and power, eventually one hand is going to go into a box that the other controls, and that ends up in conflict. But the weird thing is that's not how this thing started. This event started because of something that happened on one day. June 28th, 1914. Now, as a history teacher, professor, I'm not big on dates. I'm not going to require you to memorize many, if any, dates, other than this definite one. Because this is the day when a domino fell that was a domino in a string of other dominoes. But unlike all the other dominoes that seemed to kind of go poof into nothing, this thing, like a snowball going down a mountain, began to grumble and grumble and grow, and before long it turned into an avalanche. Does anyone know what happened on June 28th, 1914? Yes?
Archduke Ferdinand was assassinated.
Archduke Franz Ferdinand was assassinated. Well done, sir. Well done. Who was the Archduke? Do you know?
He was heir to the Austro-Hungarian throne.
Very good. Two for two. Do I dare ask you what Austro-Hungary was?
It was Austria and Hungary. They were a combined kingdom at the time.
Nice. Call it an empire, but yeah.
Empire kingdom.
Yeah. All right. So he, Franz Ferdinand, was the younger brother of the emperor, Franz Joseph. Franz Joseph's son killed himself, suicide. So he was christened to be the successor. As the heir, one of his jobs was to go out and do site visits throughout the empire. And on June 28th, 1914, he gets on a train, leaves Vienna, and travels southerly down to the city of Sarajevo in the territory known as Bosnia. Bosnia was taken by the Austro-Hungarian Empire just a few decades before. And it was filled with a different racial group than either the Germans, who were the Austrians, or rather the Austrians are Germans, or the Hungarians. And as a result, the Bosnians didn't really like being controlled by the Austrians or the Hungarians. And there was a lot of tension. So the decision was made by the Archduke to go down and do a visit. To basically let the people know, hey, we love you too. Politics. Politics. Now the plan was, how are you? Good. I got your email. The plan was simple. Go down, observe a practice run by the local military units stationed in Sarajevo, then go visit a museum, see some Bosnian works of art, then go to City Hall, give a nice little speech, then get on his train and go home. If you ever pay attention to the news, every now and then you'll hear about how the vice president, you know, goes somewhere and engages in a diplomatic mission. No difference. Interestingly enough, the Archduke actually brought his wife with him, Sophie. Now, the one thing that was very weird about June 28th was it was one of those days on the calendar that was very important. June 28th, first, was the 14th wedding anniversary of the Archduke and his wife, Sophie. Now, Sophie never traveled with the Archduke. Never. In their 14 years plus together, she never went on any of these visits that the Archduke went on. But according to their son, she had a bad feeling that something was bad going to happen. So she went with her husband out of fear that the bad thing would happen, that she would kind of protect him. Of course, that's going to add to the tragedy, because she was 100% right. So if you ever get that weird feeling in your stomach, listen to it. 2, June 28th is also a day of religious significance to the Eastern Orthodox Church. It's the Feast of St. Vitus. You don't have to remember that. But V-I-T-U-S if you ever want to look into it. St. Vitus was a Christian saint that lived in Sicily back during the days of ancient Rome. During the reign of the Emperor Diocletian, who engaged in a Christian purge, St. Vitus sacrificed his life to save Christian children. And thus he was martyred. For some reason, the Serbian people, of which the Bosnians were of that ethnic group, viewed St. Vitus as an important saint. So they celebrated on that day. The last was, to a degree, it was the anniversary of a hugely important historical battle. See, we in America don't understand history, because America, as a country, has only been here since 1783, when the Treaty of Paris was signed. We're just a babe. Just a baby. These people celebrate events that happened hundreds of years before. So on June 28, 1389, there was a huge battle near the city of Kosovo. In that battle, the Serbian people fought against the Ottomans, the Muslims. And the Muslims attempted to conquer and subvert the Christian Serbian people. Well, unfortunately, they lost the battle. But one of the princes, a man by the name of Prince Lazar, once again gave his life protecting Christian soldiers from the Muslims. So it was their kind of like attempted or failed attempted anniversary of like Independence Day. 3 big events, one day. Third time's the charm, but we're going to add a fourth. Now ultimately, the Archduke was informed of these facts. So he was willing to give up on his anniversary to essentially go down and, in a show of goodwill, pay respect to the people of Bosnia, to pay respect to their religious and historical traditions. But here's the thing. As it turned out, the Serbs were very annoyed, because they kind of viewed this visit as gate crashing. You ever have like a social event and just someone shows up and you're like, dude, what the hell? We don't want you here. Well, to a degree, that's what the Serbs felt. Now, unfortunately for the Archduke, and he was not aware of this fact, but a bunch of Serbs who were prepared to use violence to attempt to get independence had targeted him for assassination, because he was the heir to the throne. Now, I know most of you probably know little history, if at all, because they don't really emphasize it in school anymore. But have any of you ever studied the 19th century, the 1800s? A little bit? There was lots of revolutions. There was lots of violence in that 100-year span. And there were lots of important political and royal figures who were actually assassinated. Not only
was the Tsar of Russia killed in a bomb explosion, but there were, the Serbian king, King Peter, he was assassinated when a bunch of assassins went in the palace with guns and basically shot not only him, but the queen and also all the ministers. I mean, lots of violence occurred. There was bombs. There was a terrorist strike on Wall Street in like 1913. I mean, lots of violence. Lots of violence. So the fact that he was targeted for assassination was no big deal, because all leading figures were targeted for assassination. But it's who, which one makes it significant. He was targeted. That's perfect timing, Justin. That's really good. Look how scary their symbol was. Ooh. In English, their name translates to unification or death. Although we generally refer to them as the Black Hand. This terrorist group was formed in Serbia, which was not part of Bosnia, within the army. And the job of those people who joined that group was attempt to create a revolution of sorts throughout the Balkans and to make a greater Serbian empire, to link the Bosnians and the Albanians and the Romanians and the Bulgarians, to link them all into one empire. And this was the group that killed the former king of Serbia. Very violent. And what inspired them? Well, they saw what Italy went through. Italy during the 1800s. Several revolutions. Lots of violence. But in the end, they unified. And Germany fought several wars before they could unify. So these people are looking at events that took place in the neighborhood and said, yeah, we can do that too. Let's cause violence, let's cause death and disruption, and we can make an empire. And their views were the exact opposite than the Archduke's. So it wasn't personal, it was politics. But do you want to know the weird thing is? This group, was wicked conservative. They wanted a dictatorial monarchy, where the Archduke was a 19th century liberal. He didn't believe in an all-powerful monarchy. He wanted there to be constitutions and separation of power in elections, and to give everybody equal treatment under the law. Usually not the type of person you'd think revolutionaries would want to whack. Questions so far? Well, the plot to kill the Archduke was devised by this man, Danilo Ilić. Ilić was a Bosnian Orthodox Serb. So he lived in Bosnia, but racially, ethnically speaking, he was Serbian, and he was a member of the Eastern Orthodox faith. He happened to be a cell leader of the Black Hand in Sarajevo. It was he, in particular, who was insulted that this man would come to their city on this holy day. So, he conceived of a plan. He gathers 6 operatives who are going to be given weapons and trained and put in positions to an attempt to kill the Archduke. They're armed with pistols, They're armed with a grenade. And they're given cyanide pills. So here's the catch. You throw your grenade or you shoot them. Then you take the cyanide pill so you don't get caught. Now the funny thing is Illich formed his plans simply by buying the newspaper. Now in the modern world, you have no idea where the world leaders are going to go. The plans of the presidents, congressmen, generally speaking, are secret. They're not disclosed. They have a tendency just to show up. So I'm thinking of when Trump was president, or when Obama was president, or Bush before him. You turn on the news, and one day, the president of the United States would be in Iraq, you know, visiting with soldiers, or Afghanistan. They just appeared. It's all done secretively. Well, back then, the itineraries were all published in the newspapers. So, on the 27th, Illich bought a newspaper that literally mapped out when the Archduke was supposed to arrive, where he was going to go, and approximately what time. So all he needed to do was take his guys and put them in place to make the kill shot. FYI, any of you ever hear of James Garfield? President of the United States? That's how he was shot. The same thing, the newspaper printed what time the president was supposed to get on a train before he, I think he was going to Buffalo to meet the son of Abraham Lincoln. So the assassin knew exactly where he was going to be, showed up at the train station, and poof, fired his gun. All right, so the plan is you take the six guys and you stage them at different points along the parade route. So as the caravan of cars come through, if one can't get them, you got six tries. So on the 28th, the Archduke arrives on schedule. He arrives at roughly, give or take, I think it was like 10 a.m. on Sunday, June 28th. He exits his train and he's met by the governor, who has arranged for other local leaders in six cars. The Archduke climbs into the third car with his wife, and they are going to depart. There's a colorized picture. Very nice automobile. This is a Graf & Stiff 2832 PS sports car. Had a big V12 engine in it, but of course it's a convertible. All right. So they get ready, 10 o'clock. They get on the train. They stop. Here's the train station. They go forward. So they leave here at 10. And this is only, I think, 2 miles in total distance. So it takes them a few minutes. They get to the military base. They get out of the cars. They look at all the soldiers lined up. He gives them some hand gestures and appreciation. Says a few kind words. Gets in his car and it continues to travel along Appian Way. Which of course is a main street that goes along the Miljacka River. Again, if you can see this picture up here, it's kind of like a canal that goes through it. So he's traveling along the road. Now here's the unfortunate thing. Security was limited. Now apparently in the original plan, troops were supposed to be mustered and were supposed to line the entire route. But the local mayor was offended by the belief that his city was unsafe. So they scrapped that plan. And an overcompensation. That one wasn't that scary. An overcompensation, instead of having all the police come out, because it was a holiday, the police chief allowed all but 58 officers to go celebrate with their families. So they could have at least put the police out, but they didn't even do that. So there were wide gaps of people standing in the crowd and very few police officials in between. Oh, before I get to that, no spoilers. Talk about the sequence. I didn't realize I was still on that click. All right, so here we go. We'll travel along the road. 10:25, right here at the point of 1. Okay? A weird series of events occur. There are 6 assassins lined up between 1 and 2. Points 1 and 2. The first assassin, a man not that you need to remember, a man by the name of Mohammed Mahed Besik, was standing there with his gun, with his grenade, looked over his left, and a cop just happened to be walking by. He got spooked. So he took his hand off both and he kind of blended into the crowd. The second assassin, standing about 20 feet away from him, the youngest of the group, a kid by the name of Vaso Kulrivik, he was sitting there daydreaming. And he didn't even see the motorcade until it went by him. He tried, apparently, to get his revolver out, but because he wasn't ready for it, it got caught up in his clothes. By the way, I know, like, all the tough, you know, shows with the gangbangers and all the rest make it look easy. Oh, I'm going to put the gun in my belt loop, and I'm going to pull it out, and I'm going to shoot. Yeah. If you've ever been around firearms and you tried doing that, good luck. Chances are the gun's going to fall down and get stuck in here, and you're going to have to shake it out, and you look like a fool. So they make holsters for. All right, third guy, who is about 15 feet beyond Vaso, actually was paying attention, saw the cars coming, took out his grenade, activated, and threw it at the Archduke's car. But, I'm going to go back to this picture. Unfortunately, it hit the ragtop and bounced backwards. Of course, had it bounced inwards, he would have been blown it up. But it bounced backwards, fell into the street. 6 cars, Archdukes in car 3, hit the ground, and as the 4th car comes, it blows, injuring the officers that were inside. Well, at that point, they hear the blast, they turn around, they saw the car behind them had blown up, so the driver puts his pedal to the metal and races all the way down to City Hall. So they didn't go to the museum. The explosion caused them to skip it. Instead, they went down to City Hall. Now, the funny thing is that Niljelnik Karbernikov, the third guy, when he threw the grenade, he did manage to not only hit the guys in the car, but civilians were also injured. So he sees the mob turn and look at him, so he injects the cyanide pill and then ran to the riverbank and threw himself in it. But he wasn't from the city, and he didn't realize in the summertime the water was very low. It wasn't even knee deep. So he jumps in and goes splat, basically, in the mud. The cyanide pill had already spoiled, so he didn't kill himself, and the mob descended, grabbed him, pummeled him, and turned him over to the police. Well, while that was going on, the 4th assassin basically started pulling out his gun as the car was racing by, but he lost his nerve because he saw that the Sophie was in the car. And he couldn't open fire and shoot at a car carrying a woman. The fifth guy, Guarvilo Princep, heard the explosion, decided that the plot was successful, turned, moved away from his position along the road, kind of got into the crowd, only to look over his shoulder and see the Archduke racing by. He figured the final guy, the sixth guy, would get him. But he didn't realize, because the sixth guy was down closer to two, Trifko Grabiz, he actually changed his mind before the parade route started filling with people. And he went home. He didn't even participate. So, weird, bizarre. But the Archduke is still alive. So, the Archduke gets into City Hall. Starts complaining about how rude of a welcome he had received. Goes off on the mayor. Goes off on the governor. Including one quote that actually made it into the newspapers. I came here on a peaceful visit and I'm greeted with bombs. This is outrageous. Now, after he gave his little spiel, he obviously changed his plans. People had suggested, well, we've dealt with the bomb, everything's under control, maybe we should still go to the museum to be respectful of the culture. However, the Duchess suggested maybe we should go to the hospital to go see the people who were wounded by the assassin attempt. So, by the way, 30 minutes have transpired. So, the Archduke agrees. They get in the car. The hospital is over here. This is where they were intending on going. But to get from the city hall to the hospital, they had to go back down the Appel Way and cross over one of the many bridges. Unfortunately, when they got into the car, they never told the driver. So the driver thought they were going to the museum. So the car starts driving down until the police chief hits the driver, because the cars were loud, the top was down, and says, whoa, we're not going to the museum. We're going to the hospital, and the hospital's on the other side of the river. So they pull into a little side street right there. That's where this guy comes in. Guarilillo Princep, the fifth assassin, had, after he saw what occurred, was frustrated and decided he was going to hang in the area just in case the Archduke came back. But he goes into a little corner delicatessen called Schiller's and gets a sandwich and is sitting there with a hoagie on the street corner eating it. Hoping and praying that maybe he'll get an attempt. You can't make this up. Just as he finishes with the sandwich, that's when the scenario where the police chief tells the driver to turn around. So the car's going, and it turns into the narrow alleyway that's next to Schiller's Delicatessen. Sitting right here outside the door on the corner is Princep. So he takes out his pistol, and this is his actual gun. That's a Browning FN Model 1910. Semi-automatic, six-round magazine, fires 380 ACP. Rimless, straight-barreled round. Takes his gun out, point-blank range, fires two shots, boom, boom. Doesn't get the third shot off, because all of the people that were excited to see the Archduke saw him take out the gun and shot, and they dove on top of him. But two bullets. Both rounds hit Sophia, who was on that side, went through her body, and went into the Archduke. She died instantly. He would die 10 minutes later. This is the closest picture. This was after the mob had beat him up and turned him over to the police And there he is, being dragged away, being tormented by people in the crowd. Now here's the funny thing. The war did not start on June 29th. There were stories in the newspaper. Ooh, Francis Ferdinand, Austrian heir, wife murdered. Assassin's bomb fails. Accomplice shot them down. Ooh, assassination may lead to war. This was on the Oregon paper. But I actually opened it up and I could read the article. The author of the article says, yes, but it's unlikely. Because cooler heads will prevail. Because the lives of two people aren't worth starting a war over. Very bizarre. Very bizarre. But look, obviously it's the headline story. There's a rebellion going on. I think that was in Puerto Rico, if I remember correctly. No, Cuba. Cuba, that's right. We got an ocean liner happened to hit a rock and sink. 840 souls died. That was the analysis of the story. So I mean, it was just a story amongst many. And June 29th comes around, June 30th, nothing happens. And the world just kind of sits back and be like, okay, we're on to the next thing. But what it was a domino that had fallen. And soon, a bunch of other dominoes in sequence would fall until it would get to the point of no return, when war would be declared 1 month later. Now, by the way, here's another thing that I want to stress, put in your head. Today, many politicians talk about avoiding war. No one in their right mind would want to start a war. We have to focus on peace. The fact that Biden is using taxpayer dollars to fund two military efforts, very controversial. For many people in our country don't think we should be involved. None of our business. But back then, the idea of war was no big deal. It was like, okay, Sunday's going to roll around, so there'll be football on. Because wars were so frequent. Because unlike today, where we obsess over peace, they obsessed over nationalism. So, as the dominoes begin to fall when we start talking about it, we're going to see that there were plenty of opportunities to stop it. But every turn, every opportunity, the people will be like, nah, it'll be fine. No big deal. We'll have a quick war. We'll send some troops in, and then we'll sit down and we'll negotiate. We'll use diplomacy. We'll change some lands. We'll give some money. Just like every single war that occurred previously, over and over again. But this is the one thing that they didn't see until it was too late. A little war became a bigger war as other nations started getting involved. And when all of the powerful nations jump in, there's no going back. Questions?
History happens all the time. But the thing that most people can't see is that when history occurs, it's the result of things that preceded it. So for instance, y'all just didn't suddenly end up being created by God in this room at whatever time the class started. You all probably had classes that happened before it. You woke up in your bed. Maybe you had breakfast or lunch.
And then yesterday was Martin Luther King. I don't know if they had anything going on campus, but maybe you took part in that, or maybe you hung out in your dorm. Saturday or Sunday, you probably moved here, unpacked all your stuff. And then before that, you were at home, and then at some point there was... So a whole bunch of series of events occurred just to get you to be here at this point, let alone the big ones. Like, you graduated from high school, you applied and got into college, you took the SATs, you got your driver's license, you went on your first date, whatever. That's history. It's not just snap. But the key to understanding history is seeing all of the steps to get there. With World War I, it's so easy to play Monday morning quarterback. Because if you look back in history, you're like, it was there, it was so obvious, why did you do this? But at the time, they were living their lives, going through the routine day by day. It's all right.
Don't make me dance. I'm awful at it. All right.
1914 happened because the map of Europe itself had changed just 40 years before. This is the way Europe had looked in 1866. You had an alliance of sorts known as the North German Confederation. You also had a Southern German Confederation. You had the Austro-Hungarian Empire. You had Bosnia, which was still part of the Ottoman Empire, as Serbia was an independent country. But you can see Turkish states. It's the Ottoman Empire. Greece was there. Italy was actually separate. I don't know. That actually is not accurate. 1866, the Kingdom of Italy did not exist to that extent. Shame on you. But France was a little bigger also. But yet after one war, the whole map had changed because Germany was created. Austro-Hungarian Empire would get control of Bosnia and Herzegovina. Italy would come into an existence, and France was cut down to size. Typical. You had a war that was short, that was quick. Lands changed. You had a treaty, it was all done. But what it would do is would create tensions. Now I keep asking the college, I want to do a class on this war, because this war is probably even more interesting. Well, actually that's not true, I can't make that case. But it's a very interesting event that few people ever heard of. Because they see the Prussian and they think it's a typo. Because their mind simply goes to, well, this Russia, what the heck is Prussia? Does anyone know what Prussia was?
It's Germany before Germany. It was like all the Germanic kingdoms and like monarchies. Yeah, where Germany was pretty much.
It was the most powerful of the 26 different German kingdoms. Yeah. Germany was not unified. They had an alliance, but each had its own kingdom. There were 26 of them. It just happened that the Prussians were the most powerful. So Prussia sought to take control of those 26 German states, to bind them together into a single empire, a Reich, with Prussia at its core. That was the brainchild of the Chancellor of Prussia, Otto von Bismarck. Loyal aide to his king, King William of Prussia. He was a nationalist. He thought it was stupid that Germany was 26 different little countries. Because he understood that if he could take the resources, the economies, the men of the 26 and blend them together, he could have at his disposal one of the most powerful countries on earth. But how do you get 26 countries, get them to agree to become one, and then allow the other 25 to be taken over by the one? How do you do that? Well, it's not easy. You have to be clever. And this man was clever. Just to share with you the fact that I am a nerd and I'm proud of it, because I like this stuff. I actually had this poster in my dorm room. I admired this guy for his brilliance. It's kind of cliche to say, but it's true. Most politicians play checkers, if they're even able to do that. Bismarck played four-dimensional chess. He made moves based on moves that he had thought of years before with dozens of possibilities and intervening steps. He was not caught up in partisanship. Realpolitik is the policies of realism. He wasn't about the Democrats or the Republicans. He wasn't about hopes and dreams and wishes. No, no. He had a goal. He wanted to unify Germany. And he was prepared to do anything to get it. Lie, cheat, steal, manipulate, abuse, whatever. As Machiavelli once famously said, the ends justify the means. And by the way, one other thing before I forget, no one could predict him. Because you know what he was famous for? Pursuing two policies that are exact opposite of one another simultaneously. So for instance, he would simultaneously pursue tax cuts and tax increases. He simultaneously would pursue economic expansion and economic reduction. You never knew what he really wanted to do. Only he knew. He would do anything. Even manipulate wars. Now, FYI, on that previous map, which was from 1866, that big block, that Northern German Confederation, you know how he accomplished that? He fought two wars. 1864, he instigated a very famous war, the Second Schleswig War against Denmark. He scared all the German states into allying with him because the Danes were so scary. And then he instigated another war 2 years later against Austria, the Seven Weeks War, because the Austrians, who were German, could not be trusted to be part of a greater Germany. And that ultimately allowed him to put the block on the 22. He only needed four to go. So how do you get those four on board? Well, you've already fought two wars against two Germanic people, and you couldn't get them on your side. So who does everyone in the world in the 19th century hate? The French! Now, FYI. This was significant. Because if you go back 200 years, France invaded what would become Germany about 40 times. They were constantly starting wars and invading, causing destruction. Heck, the Napoleonic War was the most significant. Today, we sit back and we say, oh, the Nazis. If we were around in the 19th century, we would say the French. The French were the arch criminals, the arch villains. Nobody liked the French. Not even the French liked the French. So the fact that Bismarck knew this was not rocket science, but he knew if he could instigate something where the French attacked Prussia, he could flip it to those four German states that didn't want to be part of a Prussian Empire and say, who are you going with? Are you team Germany or are you team French?
Oh, by the way, the French, they had no problems going to war. They were as willing to engage in war as the Germans were. Because again, it's hard to fathom. They liked war. Because war was an opportunity for men to be men. To go out and fight gallantly for their country. To win honor and glory.
But how do you start a war? Because if you start the war, then you're the aggressor. And if you're the aggressor, that makes you the bad guy. And you don't want to be the bad guy. Bismarck wanted to be seen as the victim. And by the way, that's why if you ever put on the news and you hear people claiming, oh, this happened to me, I was victimized. All they're trying to do is get sympathy. And sometimes, which is really sad, they don't tell the truth. You didn't break it, did you?
No.
Okay, good. Okay, good. I had that happen once.
Really?
Student dropped the phone in class. Screen shattered. It's like, oh. As long as you're good.
Okay.
All right, true story. I don't share this often. By the way, I always, for those of you who never had me before, I'll constantly inject analogies so you can kind of understand where I'm going. So, someone telling a lie to be a victim to get sympathy. Back before I met my beloved Mrs. Professor Lomanic, I was dating a young woman who I determined at one point was absolutely psycho. And I decided I wanted nothing more to do with her. So I did the gentlemanly thing. And there was no text, so I didn't break up with her via text. I went to her apartment and I said, I'm sorry, it's not you, it's me. And I just don't want to be with you anymore. So good luck, enjoy your life. Fine, we only been dating for a couple of months. About 3 months later, I get a call. I'm pregnant. And I'm sitting there. Wait, how far along are you? You know, what? And I'm doing the mental calculations. Could it be? Well, probably, maybe, I don't know. It didn't quite feel right because it was about 3 months later and she said she was about 2 months along. And I'm sitting there like, I know I didn't randomly show up at your house. But I'm like, okay, fine. Yeah, why are you calling me? Well, I was in college at the time, but I also had a job, so I had some money, I had a decent car. So, you know, I had the ability, if worse comes to worse, drop out of school and be a dad or whatever. But I was clever. I said, okay, that's fine. Let's go get a blood test. Let's determine if I am actually the dad. And we went, and lo and behold, it was not me. And I said to her, why did you do this to me? Well, I missed you and I wanted to get back together. So getting knocked up from another guy and then calling me expecting me to come running? No sympathy. No sympathy. Actually, I didn't have a cell phone then. There was no cell phones. So I actually changed the landline in my apartment so she could never call me again. And I moved shortly thereafter, just out of coincidence. So for Bismarck, he didn't want to be that girl saying, oh, I'm pregnant, and you're the hot dad. Because if it was discovered, he would look bad. So he needed to play up an opportunity. And lo and behold, fate gave it to him. Because there was a death in Spain. Spain had a monarchy. And the Spaniards decided they were going to have a revolution. They had their own glorious revolution, and in 1868, they removed from the throne the queen, Isabella II. Now, the government that was set up began looking for another monarch. And they, as they're doing their recruiting, stumbles upon a prince of the German state of Hohenzollern. Who was like a distant cousin of a cousin of a cousin. So the Spanish government basically says to this German prince, We want you to come and be king. Well, Bismarck gets word of this, and he's fully in favor of it, because Prince Leopold was a relative of William, the King of Prussia. So this geopolitically would now mean you had an alliance of sorts between Spain and the German states, with France kind of in between. But Napoleon III, the Emperor of France, was outraged by this. So much so, he threatened to invade Spain if the Spanish picked Prince Leopold to be their king. And by the way, at this point, Spain was no longer the Spain of like Ferdinand and Isabella at the time of Columbus. Spain was a third-rate power, if at all. So, threatened by war, Spain withdraws the candidacy. France then demands that Spain look for no other prince of German blood to take the crown. To which Spain says, fine. But Bismarck is pissed.
So he decided to manipulate things. Two policies at the same time.
As it turned out, the French ambassador, a man by the name of Count Vincent Benetti, contacts King William to have a meeting, to discuss what had taken place. Because Napoleon III did not want William to feel slighted. Diplomacy. So they meet. Apparently, the French ambassador asked William to publicly agree that having a German prince as the Spanish monarch was a bad idea. To which William politely said, no, I don't really feel like getting involved. It has nothing to do with me. All cordial. All based on protocol. But Bismarck gets a transcript from one of his secretaries, who was in Ems at the palace where William met the French ambassador. And he gave back that report. The ambassador asked for something. The king politely said no. They shook hands. They had a cocktail. And then they went their own separate ways. So in comes the edits. Bismarck takes the telegram. And he rewrites it in two forms. One form would be sent to the French press. The other form would be sent to the German press. The French version had it seem as if William insulted the ambassador, refused to even discuss things, belittled him, insulted him, used derogatory language at him. And then Bismarck secretly sent the copy to the French press. He also had a German version, in which the French ambassador was rude and insulting. And he anonymously, secretly, sent that off to the German press. It gets into the papers in both countries. The French people are outraged. How dare the Prussians insult us? The Germans are outraged. How dare the French insult us? And both sides began demanding that their honor is satisfied. We have to have a war! Before King William can declare war, Bismarck is sitting there basically saying, hold, 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 wait for it. Because he knew the French people were not happy with Napoleon III. Because he had raised taxes. And the people were calling for a possible revolution. So guess what politicians like to do when they're politically in trouble?
Start wars.
Yeah, because that's the biggest distraction you can get, right? Oh, don't pay attention to what's going over here. Pay attention to this. Oh, look, there's a war. Yeah, we hate the Germans. Yeah, this will be awesome. Don't overthrow me. Now, truth be told, one of the reasons why Napoleon did this was because he had contacted the Austrians. And he basically got the emperor, Franz Joseph, to promise that if Prussia declares war and attacks France, that Austria would attack Prussia from the south. But unbeknownst to Napoleon, Bismarck had contacted the Tsar of Russia, who hated Franz Joseph in Austria, and Bismarck got the Russians to agree that if Austria attacks Prussia, Russia's going to attack Austria. And then he secretly leaked the news to the Austrians. And so the Austrian emperor gets word that, oh my God, if we attack Prussia, the Russians are going to attack us. The Austrians stood down. So when Napoleon declared war, they declared neutrality. And it was just Napoleon against 26 German states. Questions? Get mindful of the time. All right, real quick. Long story short, France had a smaller army. When war was declared, they had about 800,000 men. They were poorly trained, poorly led. But they did have the superior rifle. The rifle that the French went in with was the chassepot rifle. So it's a bolt action, breech loading, but it's a one round shot. The chassepot was about the fourth or the fifth rifle to use the bolt action system. So you use the handle, you open the chamber, you push the bullet in, and then you close it up. The advantage of the chassepot was that they had developed rubber seals. So when they closed the breech, it was tight. So when the round was discharged, all of the force caused the bullet to come out of the end of the barrel. Had an effective range of about 1,500 yards. They had the better rifle. But they were still using old-fashioned Napoleonic muzzle-loading cannons that fired cannonballs. So you'd have to tilt the gun up, you'd have to clean it all down, and you'd have to pack the round in and then all the powder. And it was very, very complicated. And the guns were old. And some of the guns, when they fired, actually cracked. But the French soldiers, brightly colored uniforms, fought the Napoleonic style, still. Block units. So let's take all the guys, line them up into multiple firing lines, and then you all march together onto the battlefield. And you stand your ground, and then you fire in sequential lines. Prussian soldiers, they didn't have heavy wool clothing. They actually had cotton uniforms. And look how big the packs are. They actually had lighter packs. Because the Prussians had spent time studying the Union Army in the American Civil War. And they realized the Americans, or the Union, won the Civil War because they took advantage of railroads. So instead of making the men march 20, 30, 50 miles, the men would get on railroads and be transported close to the battlefield. So the men didn't have to carry as much weight. Technically, they had an inferior rifle. This is the Dreyse's needle gun. This was actually the first version of the breech loading rifle. The problem was, though, it had no seal. So it fired the same basic type of cartridge, but when you pulled the trigger and it detonated, a lot of the gases escaped through the breech, so the bullet didn't travel as far as fast. But they had superior cannon. They utilized breech-loading cannon that basically fought bullets. So instead of having to muzzle-load it, you could open up the breech in the back, put the round in, lock it up, pull the firing pin, and you could get off 5 rounds to 1 round of the French. Plus, the Prussians, learning from the American Civil War, didn't use the firing lines. Have you ever seen any documentaries on the Civil War? Talk about a war you would not want to be involved in. Guys, big groups. Oh, let's walk real close to the enemy as they're shooting at us. That sounds like a brilliant idea. Learning from that, the Prussians used smaller squads and groups. They didn't march in big blocks, but rather they were mobile. They stayed down, shot from behind things, even from the ground. And instead of marching right at the enemy, they always used encircling tactics. So you have a group in the front, but you send your flanks out wide to encircle the enemy. It's called en masse and destroy. Plus, the Germans, or the Prussians, had the highest skilled and trained officer corps on the whole continent. The leaders knew how to fight wars. This is why the war only lasted 6 months. And this is significant because this is what the people in 1914 thought the war would be like. The Germans penetrated all of their force through the tiny strip of land that France and Germany shared a border with. As you can see by the black lines, they sent through multiple armies and they fanned out. The first battle was on August 4th. The war was over by January 28th, ironically. So they spread out and they encircled French armies. France, when the war started, had three. And they managed to take each one. Of course, the funniest thing was the Second Army, which Napoleon III himself led, and was captured. So they captured the emperor. You just can't make it up. The only reason why the war lasted as long is because the Prussians ordered the soldiers not to bombard Paris. They didn't want to blow Paris up. So they basically laid siege to it. They encircled it and starved them out. And the Parisians lasted like 3 months before they finally surrendered. Now here's the thing. And this also should have been a warning for 1914, if they only read history. Casualties during this war were shockingly high for a war that only lasted 6 months. France had 140,000 deaths on the battlefield, plus another 143,000 casualties, injured, wounded people. Although my favorite stat of them all was the fact that 480,000 French soldiers surrendered. They would rather surrender than die. Whereas the German side, less, 45,000 dead, 90,000 wounded. But here's the most shocking casualty report. These battles were fought in and around urban centers. Not like back in the day where armies would prearrange meetings out in the countryside somewhere. The German soldiers actually went into villages and towns, and civilians were caught. Somewhere between 200 and 250,000 civilians died. Plus, another 165,000 German civilians died. Because some of the Germans caught smallpox in France and brought it back to Germany. So there was a pandemic in the middle of it. Death, my friends. Death. Latest technology, urban tactics, death. But you do it all for the spoils. And this will be the last click. This quick war ended with a treaty, like all of the wars of the 19th century. This was the Treaty of Frankfurt, Frankfurt signed in 1871. In it, Germany got land. I think I have the click. No, I don't. Go back. Germany got land. I'll spell it for you because I know we're going to see it down the road. But these territories, I'm going to say it over and over again. They got the territories of Alsace, spelled A-L-S-A-C-E. A-L-S-A-C-E, Alsace. And the territory of Lorraine. L-O-R-R-A-I-N-E. L-O-R-R-A-I-N-E. Alsace and Lorraine. Both had originally been German territories. But Alsace was seized by Louis XIV, and Lorraine was seized by Louis XV. Back then, it was just land. But in the 19th century, coal was discovered underneath the ground. So Bismarck wanted those two territories because 70% of France's coal reserves were in those two territories. So Bismarck took it to cripple the German economy. The French economy. And two, money made France pay an indemnity. In today's money, about $520 billion. So long story short, that's the way wars were up until the 20th century. Quick, mobile, before you kill all the enemy, you negotiate a treaty, and to the winner goes the spoils. So when we see Austria and Russia and Germany and France and England all jumping into World War I, it's because they expected it to be just like the Franco-Prussian War. Short, quick, change some land, pay some money. Whew. Questions? Going to engage. Make sure you're still linked in. Watch the syllabus review video for those guys who came in late. Tomorrow, the syllabus review extra credit quiz will open up at 8 a.m. You have all day to take it. So whenever you get a chance, you only get 10 minutes to do it. All extra credit. Start the semester off strong. If you have any questions, don't hesitate to send me an email. I should be around tomorrow. All right? Hasta.
Thanks, Professor. Yep.
All right. Justin, who are you?
Jacob.
Do you have a pen?
Yeah, I do.
You were like right about here behind Annabelle, I think. So yeah. Just write your name there.
Okay. And wrap your car.